reconvene. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. I'm going to call our second case, 1006-8B, 1114 CR, State of Wisconsin versus Copenhagen. Mr. Connell, arguing on behalf of Mr. Copenhagen, you may proceed. Is it Copenhagen or Copenhagen? How do you pronounce your client's name?
Oh,
fine.
It pleases the court. My name is Jim Connell, and I represent Michelle Copenhagen. Ms. Copenhagen seeks review of the Court of Appeals decision, which reversed a trial court's order suppressing evidence obtained by the seizure of Ms. Copenhagen's bank records during a criminal investigation in Oneida County in 2004. The Court of Appeals held that the seizure of the bank records without a finding of probable cause did not violate Ms. Copenhagen's state and federal constitutional right to be free from unreasonable search and seizure. The Court of Appeals also held that suppression was not an available remedy for the state's violation of the subpoena for production of documents statute, section 968.135. And finally, the Court of Appeals refused to address the issue of whether the trial court had the inherent authority to exclude evidence obtained in violation of section 968.135 because the trial court had not invoked its inherent authority in its ruling on the suppression issue. Michelle Copenhagen's position is that she does have a constitutionally protected interest in her bank records. She contends that a violation of section 968.135 does require suppression of illegally obtained evidence and that suppression is necessary in this case due to the blatant misuse of process by the state. First contention Michelle has raised involves Article 1, Section 11 of the Wisconsin Constitution. The wording of this constitutional provision is nearly identical to that used in the Fourth Amendment to the United States Constitution. State's brief sets forth a long line of cases which acknowledge what has been called a lockstep approach, where the search and seizure provisions of the state constitution have been interpreted in tandem.
Counsel, I don't mean to throw you off the argument here, but I just wanted to know, are you abandoning the Fourth Amendment argument and just arguing the state constitution at this
point? No, I am making a Fourth Amendment argument, Your Honor. I'm starting with Article 1, Section 11. Frankly, I think it's the strongest argument I have.
Thank you. I didn't mean to throw you off there.
While the court has in these cases indicated that it will respect Fourth Amendment jurisprudence, this court has also acknowledged that if it determines that the Constitution and laws of this state demand greater protection of citizens' liberties, it will not be bound by the minimum standards imposed by federal courts. This notion was forcefully stated in a concurring opinion in 2005 in State versus Knapp, which dealt with a Fifth Amendment right. In State versus Young, decided last year, the court held that it would not always follow the United States Supreme Court's lead interpreting our search and seizure provisions. In State versus Eason, decided several years ago, this court adopted the good faith exception to the exclusionary rule, but added preconditions to the application of the rule that are not required by federal court's interpretation of the Fourth Amendment. Today's case I believe, presents an issue where the court ought to hold that our Constitution, Wisconsin's Constitution, affords greater rights to the people of this state than afforded by the Supreme Court's interpretation of the Fourth Amendment in the United States versus Miller. There are several reasons why I think that ought to be the case here. One reason involves how our court has viewed the exclusionary rule in a somewhat different light than the United States Supreme Court. In Mapp versus Ohio, the United States Supreme Court stressed that deterrence of future police misconduct was the primary goal of the exclusionary rule. In Wisconsin, we adopted the exclusionary rule 40 years before Mapp. Beginning with that decision, the stress, I believe, in the cases is that the exclusionary rule vindicates a defendant's personal rights. The aim of the rule is to restore a defendant to the same position as if government officials had acted within the law, had stayed within the law. In Hoyer versus State, the court referred to Article 1, Section 11 as a pledge of faith that the people of this state shall be secure against unreasonable search and seizure. It's an affirmative promise to the people of this state. Another reason why I believe a lockstep interpretation.
Mr. Connell?
Yes, Your Honor.
Why do you think that what occurred here is an unreasonable search and seizure?
Well, Your Honor, I believe, and I was just getting to this point, that people do have a reasonable expectation of privacy in their bank records. United States Supreme Court in Miller held that because the bank records are not the customer's records but the bank's records, that we don't have that reasonable expectation of privacy. And I think that that approach is wrong.
You know, when I was thinking about this case this morning, I was thinking about it in the light of some cases, one case in particular decided 20-some years ago by this court, having to do with garbage and having to do with the turning over of garbage to a third person. In other words, the garbage going out on the street in the typical situation. Isn't this very similar?
Well, I think that it can be distinguished. And distinguished in this way, I think it was Stevens was the name of the case that allowed the garbage search. The rationale was when a person puts their trash out, they're abandoning it. I think when a person provides information to the bank, he or she is not abandoning that information, not giving up the expectation of privacy that I think we have in bank records.
Counselor, if the grocery store had simply sued your client for conversion in a civil action rather than this being a criminal action where the state is proceeding on it in a different forum, couldn't these records have simply been gotten by a subpoena under Chapter 80409 by a lawyer to a third party?
Well, I would expect that the grocery store would use the same type of subpoena that was used in this case, incorrectly. But if that subpoena had been issued to the banks, Michelle Popenhagen would have had the opportunity to contest the subpoena, to quash the subpoena, to say this information is not relevant to this case. If this was a landlord-tenant dispute and the landlord attempted to subpoena the tenant's bank records, the tenant should come to court and ask that the court set aside that subpoena. In this case, Michelle Popenhagen didn't have that opportunity. These records were obtained in secret.
Yeah, but does the Fourth Amendment cover a civil case where the government isn't involved in subpoenaing?
Well, you're right, yes.
No privacy protection.
Well, I think that perhaps you could argue some privacy protection.
But not under the Fourth Amendment.
But, no, that's certainly true, Your Honor, that there is
you
no.
You might argue trademark, confidentiality, work product, but not Fourth Amendment.
Not the Constitution, you're correct.
And you're relying on the Article I, Section 11.
I am. And the second reason why I think.
But if this subpoena had been proper under the statute and that there had been probable cause for the subpoena, okay, and then the subpoena had been served and the bank turned over the records, would you have a case?
Well, I suppose I could make a different argument than I'm making
what
in this case.
What would your argument
I'm
be?
Not arguing that Section 968.135 doesn't provide protection by virtue of the fact that it requires a neutral and detached magistrate
right.
to make a determination
mm-hmm.
of
right.
probable cause.
And that would be okay under the Fourth Amendment. I mean, you have a privacy in your home. Officers cannot enter the house. If they have a search warrant based on probable cause, and it's good, then you have a reasonable expectation of privacy in your home, but there can be a search under the Fourth Amendment.
That's correct.
So if everything was okay here as to the subpoena, probable cause, and it neutral magistrate, you wouldn't be here, I don't think.
That's correct, Your Honor. The point that I'm making, the position that I'm taking, is it is that lack of the following procedure that's set forth in the statute, but which I think also protects your Fourth Amendment in Article 1, Section 11, right to unreasonable search and seizure. That protection being that the state must go to a judge and put before him or her probable cause to believe that the evidence has value and that just simply was not done in this case.
The unreasonableness is that there was no probable cause shown on the record.
That's correct.
It may have been probable cause.
Well, I'm not going to concede that point,
no.
but
okay.
The fact of the matter is Judge Mangerson, Judge Kinney issued these subpoenas without making a determination of probable cause.
Okay.
Do you know what the procedure is in Oneida County for obtaining subpoenas like these?
I think that it was explained by Judge Mangerson in the record in this case, and he indicates that the typical procedure is for the state to provide an affidavit, typically two affidavits, one by law enforcement, typically which would give the background of the case and the reasons why law enforcement believes there's evidence, and one by the district attorney. Those affidavits are submitted with the subpoena for production of documents. The judge makes a determination as to whether probable cause exists. They set an arbitrary date, I guess a return date of the criminal court, where the person subpoenaed must produce the records, and typically they also give that person the opportunity to produce them before the hearing. That's how Judge Mangerson explained the procedure.
That'd be under 968-135.
That's correct.
Under 80507, though, did they obtain these through the clerk of courts, or do you know where these subpoenas came from? Because these are civil subpoenas used for a criminal investigation, which is a little...
Frankly,
different.
The record is not very clear. No explanation was ever really given as to how they came to follow this procedure in this case. A civil subpoena that had the name of the district attorney of Oneida County was given to the judge, and frankly, I think Judge Mangerson conceded that it was on a pile of papers, and he signed this subpoena without giving proper attention to the lack of probable cause or the lack of an affidavit or testimony.
Well, he did one, Judge Kinney did two, but I was just trying to figure out if there's ever, you know, if using a civil subpoena for a criminal matter is an unusual way to proceed.
It's unusual, and I don't think the district attorney or any representative of the state ever explained how this came about. except that everyone concedes that it was a mistake.
Could 968-135 have been used a second time? We made a mistake the first time. We're going to do it all over again.
Well, I guess that presents a second issue, and I suppose if I would take the position that if the records were obtained illegally, that taints the evidence.
Oh.
Well, it seems to me, and I don't know how it would be used the second time, because I don't know exactly what probable cause would be used the second time, but I think that they would be using the records obtained illegally to obtain the records through the due process provisions of 968.135, and I would suggest that that's not a proper procedure.
Well, you would argue that there never was probable cause.
Well, that's
for the
correct.
Subpoena.
That's correct.
But your view on that might not be correct. There's an alternative view, I suspect.
That's correct, but what I'm telling the court here today is that no judge has ever made that determination, and that is what is required by Section 968.135. There's probable cause to issue the subpoena.
So you're saying it's more than just a defect in the subpoena, it's a defect in...
Well, yes, I believe that Section 968.135 was enacted to protect the constitutional right that we're arguing about today. That is, the right to be free from an unreasonable search and seizure of records like, in this case, Michelle Popenhagen's bank records. I think...
Help me then distinguish Miller. How is this different than Miller? Because Miller goes further than that. They say they see no reason why the existence of a Fourth Amendment interest turns on whether a subpoena is defective. Therefore, we don't limit our consideration to the situation in which there's an alleged defect in the subpoena served on the bank. And then they say it's okay.
Well,
that's the United States Supreme Court.
The United States versus Miller is a problem. And I'm urging this court to find that our Constitution provides greater protection than does the interpretation of the Supreme Court in United States versus Miller. I believe that in Wisconsin we have a tradition and a history of the respect for the right of privacy, that Section 968.135 was adopted in part because of that respect for privacy. I think that we've got other legislation in this state. We've got a civil right to for the invasion of privacy. We do have laws that protect privacy in a number of areas, and I think that there is a reasonable expectation of privacy in bank records.
Counsel, if I could ask, with respect to your statutory argument, did you, in the course of this appeal, make an argument regarding substantive due process or no?
No.
All right. Thank
you. I based the appeal on the state and federal constitutional protection against unreasonable search and seizure. I believe that Section 968.135 demands suppression even if there is no constitutional right to protection of bank records. And I believe there was an abusive process in this case, and I think those are the four arguments that I have made. Although I do believe that Ms. Popenhagen's trial counsel mentioned substantive due process in his arguments to Judge Mangerson.
In these, Arnold, go ahead.
Do you think that the Swift case is a case that you have to distinguish to win here?
I'm asking that the Swift case be overruled. And I think it should be overruled on state constitutional law grounds that basically our state constitution provides greater protection than the Fourth Amendment. I also believe that that the United States versus Miller is no longer controlling precedent, that in the 30-plus years since the United States Supreme Court decided that case under the Fourth Amendment, that there have been statutory developments that have superseded the ruling in United States versus Miller.
Even though there's been statutory developments, the Miller decision was based on the Fourth Amendment.
Fourth Amendment, you're right.
So wouldn't that still take precedence over the Congress's different approach with respect to the statute?
Well, I'll be frank that that's the reason that I didn't make the Fourth Amendment the centerpiece of this argument. I'm arguing the state constitution. I also argue the Fourth Amendment for a different reason, and that is I think it's time that United States versus Miller be explicitly overruled. I think that, frankly, the development of state and federal laws, the federal law being the federal right to privacy law, the state law being enactments like 968.135 have sort of taken the sting out of Miller. There's no opportunity for this issue to be addressed anymore because most law enforcement agencies are respecting those laws. In this case, they didn't. In this case, there was a complete lack of the kind of due process that I think the Constitution and the statute requires.
May I ask you, Mr. Connell, 968.135, you say that it was not complied with. But there is a sentence at the end of that section. This section does not limit or affect any other subpoena authority provided by law. What's wrong with 805.07?
Well, I think what's wrong is that we have the expectation of privacy in records held by third-party record keepers like banks, particularly banks who have our records in their possession. I think that a procedure, a civil procedure, you'd have an opportunity in advance. And frankly, the federal right to privacy and banking privacy law requires advance notice to customers of the fact that the government wants to access their banking records. That wasn't done in this case. And I think that that's, you know, that finding of probable cause is essential.
Now, if we look at the Justice Prosser's question, that would mean that provided by law means that 805 subpoena applies in a federal, in a criminal case. If 805 applied in a criminal case, why would you need 968.135?
You wouldn't. And I think that particularly in this type of procedure. In this case, this was a pre-charging investigatory stage of the case. I think you have to follow 968.135.
968.135 only gives the state the right to a subpoena. Is that right? Not the defendant.
That's right.
But don't you think the defendant has a right to subpoena?
Well, certainly during the course of a criminal proceeding, the defendant has a right to issue subpoenas. The state has a right to issue subpoenas. And I suppose subpoenas, deuces taken for the production of documents. But in the context of a criminal proceeding, the parties would have notice and an opportunity to object. This procedure, this section 968.135, it was utilized in this case to get Ms. Popenhagen's records during the investigatory stage of the proceeding before, without notice to her and without an opportunity by her to object.
This is a discovery subpoena.
That's correct. It's like a search warrant. It immediately follows the statutory search warrant procedure in the statutes.
And the general concept is that the state has discovery pre-trial, but not the defendant.
I guess that's the rationale. But the statute provides, and I think this is the important point, that there be probable cause. 968.12, search warrants are issued upon probable cause. In the following statute, the subpoena for production of documents statute, subpoenas can only be issued under that section upon probable cause.
May I ask, Mr. Connell, if you were running a John Doe investigation, what subpoena statute would you use?
Well, you know, there's a controversy about that, I think. A recent case, I may have cited it here, and I think it's got some In Re John Doe proceeding as the title of the case, referred to Section 968.135. Dissent said in that case that that statute is not applicable to John Doe proceedings.
Doesn't the John Doe have its own?
That's correct.
I haven't read that statute for a while, but
I think you authored the dissent, anyways, Your Honor. But I think you said that 968.135 does not apply.
But there is, I think, a subpoena power right within
There's an independent statute that provides for the subpoena power in John Doe proceedings.
Yep. And there's a question that is whether or not John Doe judge has to issue every subpoena that's requested or that there's discretion in a John Doe. That's my understanding of cases that are
I think the same type of issue could apply in those proceedings regarding what happens if the procedure is not followed, what is the proper procedure.
Now, this court, as I understand it, and I'm just looking back at the Stark case, which was a 1978 case. In that case, there was a search warrant case.
That was a search warrant case.
And that case involved, if I remember, was that bank records too?
That involved bank records as well.
And what the court did, they had search warrants had a few little problems in them, but as I remember the case and reading it, the court said the search warrants were good enough, and therefore it fell within a reasonable search, but they never decided whether there was an expectation of privacy in the bank records.
That's correct. I think in terms of the state constitution, we're writing on a clean slate here. Your Honor, you and the then Chief Justice urged that this court address that issue in 1977 in Stark, but it wasn't
addressed. Right after Miller. I mean, it was in time soon after Miller.
Yeah, that's correct. It was 1977, the year after Miller.
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Your time went quickly. James M. Frymuth, Assistant Attorney General, representing the state of Wisconsin. Counsel.
Good morning. Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I am Assistant Attorney General James Frymuth, representing the state of Wisconsin as respondent in this appeal. This case is in a pretrial posture. Michelle Popenhagen stands charged in Oneida County with one count of theft of approximately $29,000 from her former employer, a grocery store.
Counsel, I'm going to just ask you a question right off the bat, obviously. Suppose you lose today and you find that there's a Fourth Amendment or Fourth Amendment, state constitutional right or a state statutory right with a remedy, and therefore these records are suppressed. Mr. Connell was asked, in effect, what good does it do you? Because tomorrow the state can do it right under 968 and go to the bank, which still has copies. They didn't give you the only copy they got. And touch all the right bases and get these records, can they?
I think it may depend on whether we're talking about a constitutional right or a statutory right.
All right.
And that's because it may depend on the extent to which you've got an exclusionary rule, taint of the poisonous tree type argument, versus in the statutory context, it might be simply an issue preclusion type argument. I'm familiar with a case that I handled, called Miller by chance, in the State Court of Appeals that involved a drunk driving prosecution in which the state violated discovery and the trial court therefore ordered suppression or exclusion, rather, of the records. The prosecutor refiled, and in the new case, both the trial court and the Court of Appeals found no problem with the state's then complying with discovery so that exclusion was not a remedy in that case. That's the only precedent that I can cite from our...
He complied with the state statute.
Correct.
So if it was a statutory basis, then, and you applied the remedy of exclusion, your theory would be they can do it right, get the records.
That's what I would argue, although I have not obviously developed that in my brief, no. And if the court would want further, I would.
But if it's a constitutional right, a state constitutional right in exclusion, can they get it? Can you get it again?
I hesitate, but I'm reluctant to say absolutely because of the taint and the exclusionary rule. It may be possible. Again, I haven't, frankly, researched that. I apologize, but I
doesn't ordinarily come up in a criminal case. I mean, they get the drugs, they seize them improperly, stifled. But I think those drugs stay in with the cops. I mean, you don't generally do that.
Right.
Or the bloody clothes—they all become part of the record in. So they're gone for another search, is what I'm trying to say.
I see what you're saying, yeah.
So it won't ordinarily come up in a criminal case unless they give them all the bloody clothes and then they search him.
In other words, because they have copies yet of the records in the bank.
That's what makes this a little different.
And I think this also gets into one thing that's sort of getting overlooked here in the analysis, both constitutionally and statutorily, and that is the nature of the documents that we're talking about, bank records. Before I launch into that, though, I'd like to, if I may, just outline
what the
court to write. First, in accordance with United States versus Miller, this court should hold that Copenhagen has no reasonable expectation of privacy in her bank records under the Fourth Amendment, so as to require a warrant or a warrant exception for government seizure of those documents. Although Congress has enacted statutes to give certain confidentiality and notice rights to bank customers, Congress cannot alter or expand the Constitution. Moreover, in those statutes, those federal statutes, there is no suppression remedy. There are purely civil remedies for a violation of the disclosure provisions of those federal statutes. Second, Copenhagen has not established a reasonable expectation of privacy in her bank records under Article 1, Section 11 of the State Constitution, our State Constitution analog to the Fourth Amendment search and seizure provision. Third, Wisconsin Statute Section 968.135, the criminal subpoena statute that applies in a pre-charging setting, does not give Copenhagen standing to challenge the issuance of judicial subpoenas to her three banks. Under this statute, only the banks, as the third-party targets of the subpoena, could have moved to quash or limit the subpoenas for the state's failure to present probable cause. In other words, this statute is intended to be a mechanism for the prosecution, for a prosecutor, to obtain records that are in the possession of a third party. By third party, I mean someone who does not have a Fourth Amendment protected interest in those records, when that party is unwilling to voluntarily consent to doing that. So that
the bank usually advise the individual?
Excuse me. I think both in advance and actually after the fact, probably should have in this case. In advance, the customer is made aware, forewarned, that documents, records, customer records may be disclosed to certain enumerated entities or in response to subpoenas. a statute cited in the reply brief of the defendant. I think it's one of the 216 or 215 statutes, and looking at those indicates that the bank is supposed to actually give notice to the customer when a subpoena has been issued for those records. I'm getting a little ahead of myself here on the statutory argument, but the statutory argument here would be that because the statute isn't designed to protect the person whose records are being sought, but is a mechanism for the third party to comply with that for its own individual interests, whether it be to avoid contract problems or a civil lawsuit, to avoid oppressive, unreasonable requests. The statute is designed to protect or for the benefit of that third party, not for the for the individual whose records are being sought.
Let me interrupt you at this point. I've been looking at the Swift case, and I know that that ties directly to the statutory argument you're making. In regard to Swift, was there any finding there that the defendant had no standing to raise the issue?
Not that I recall. I believe the Court of Appeals reached the question of probable cause and said we're going to find it. Now, that doesn't mean, I would argue, that issue means that they did have standing. It just wasn't addressed, I believe, in Swift. I think the argument went directly to the fact that there was probable cause. We're not going to worry about whether there was standing since, in other words, we're going to assume there was standing, there was probable cause. But as far as I remember Swift, there certainly was no discussion of standing in that context.
The other thing about Swift that I found fascinating, and perhaps it's just me that would find it fascinating, but Swift seems to me to be a very different situation. The Court of Appeals looks at what happened in Swift, a voluntary turning over of additional records, and finds there was no state action, and that seems to be significant, at least as Judge Mize writes the opinion. Here, isn't it very different? There is state action.
There is state action in the sense of the banks. There was an application to the courts for a subpoena, and of course, as everybody, as we've conceded from the beginning, this wasn't followed in the proper manner because there was no affidavit presented with that. And then the subpoenas were delivered to the bank. So process was used in this case. My argument here is that the process that was used, while violative of the statute, because it's in a pre-charging setting, doesn't merit suppression for two reasons. One, because the statute doesn't expressly require suppression or state that, and there's a long line of case law in Wisconsin that says for a statutory violation, we're not going to suppress records unless the statute provides for that.
Counsel, may I ask you a brief question?
Sure.
In Swift, it seemed as if the violation was that the records were not returned to the court. But it was a subpoena that was done under 968.135.
Okay.
Do you agree or disagree that the wrong statute was used here, the wrong subpoena?
I agree that it was the wrong subpoena statute that was used. Yes.
Okay. So if there's a violation, it's that the wrong number is on the subpoena, for one, right?
Correct.
Two, there is no probable cause established to a court, the issuing court, right?
Correct.
And then if you turn to 968.135 and you look in the body of the statute itself, because I'm interested in the statutory language here. We've got Miller that talks a lot about precedent regarding constitutional issues, but when you look to the body of the statute, and this is what you were just talking about, it says motions to the court, including but not limited to motions to quash or limit the subpoena, shall be addressed to the court which issued the subpoena. So why isn't that a statutory provision that allows for someone to bring a motion to quash the subpoena? And if you look at Black's dictionary, quash means to annul or make void or terminate, to suppress or subdue, to crush. Why isn't a statutory argument that suppression is appropriate?
I would argue that the reference to the various motions are references to types of action that can be brought. Doesn't expand who can bring them. The statute only requires that the subpoenas be issued to the banks, and there's no statutory requirement, at least in this 968.135, that the suspect, uncharged suspect, has any standing to challenge those subpoenas. So the bank had, the bank for various reasons could move to quash because, in this case there was, one of the problems in this case was both the judges and the banks overlooked the fact that there was no caption. And had there been a caption, that would have clued them in that this, okay, was an 80507 case, in which case that's the way it should work. Without a caption, somebody should have picked up on that we need probable cause shown here. But the argument is that the statute only speaks to.
So the bank would have to make that motion, not
Ms. Correct. That's the argument.
The wording of the statute doesn't say that. I mean, if the bank under law is required to give notification of, if under, it is required to give notification of this kind of activity, in other words, filing of a subpoena, you know, it's almost like our open records law. That gives the opportunity then for the person who's the subject of the records to come forth and make a motion. In the text of the statute, I don't see any limitation prohibiting a suspect from making such a motion.
Sure. The statute is silent. It just says motions to can be made. But my argument is that because we're talking about a pre-charging situation, and it could be any number of suspects, the purpose of this is to assist the prosecution in getting these documents and assist the third party in deciding whether to turn them over or not, not to allow the potential suspect to participate in that determination. But if the bank gave notice in this case, had given notice in this case, I still think the statute doesn't permit Popenhagen at that point to participate in challenging that finding of probable cause.
Let me ask, follow up Justice Bradley's question, and I'm going to take you back to the constitutional argument, because my understanding of the Miller case is that they were dealing with a fact situation that was in accord with, quote, existing legal process, end quote. And I know there's some discussion in Miller about California Bankers Association versus
Schultz.
And there's a little bit more extensive discussion of that criteria there where the court notes that both the legislative history and the regulations make specific reference to the fact that access to the records is to be controlled by existing legal process. So I guess my question under Miller and Schultz is, does the reasonable expectation of privacy or lack thereof that the prosecution is standing on now exist only when there is compliance with existing legal process, or if there is no compliance with existing legal process, does that so-called standing argument that was recognized in Miller fall by the wayside?
I think the latter, and I'm, if I understand what you're asking, I think the latter is true, and I point to a footnote in Miller at page 446 of Miller, footnote 9. The court said there was no reason to address the propriety of the subpoenas, and actually the subpoenas in Miller were remarkably similar to the problem here. They were issued by a district attorney rather than a court. There was no return made to a court, and they were returnable on a date when the grand jury was not in session. But the court said there was no reason to address the propriety of the subpoenas in light of finding no reasonable expectation of privacy in the bank records because, quote, the banks upon which they were served did not contest their validity. The suggestion to me is there, and I haven't looked at the federal statute, the subpoena statute, so I don't know how to compare that language to our 968.135, but the argument would be that if it's similar, for the same reason, there was no standing here.
So that even if there was a violation of existing legal process, it would be the bank that would have the ability to bring this up, and they would have standing and not the defendant in this action.
That's our argument, and that the defendant's remedies in this situation are limited to civil.
But what other kinds of documents could be subpoenaed under 968.135?
I think it's pretty open-ended. It doesn't really say, other than the definition in the 968.13.2, documents includes but is not limited to books, papers, records, recordings, tapes, photographs, films, or computer or electronic data. So it's a smorgasbord of potential documents that could be gotten.
Medical records?
I think I think so, but I think there may be a statutory provision that may govern that accessibility in addition to the privilege that attaches to those. There's no, as I understand it, no privilege that's recognized in Wisconsin law for customer bank communications or dealings, unlike with the medical records. But
could be records of a private corporation?
I think so.
That had some relationship to this defendant?
I think so. I wish I had an answer for the medical records. I'm not 100% sure, but they may be.
One of the things that concerns me about this case is the old golden rule, in part being in closing argument, you can't say to the jurors, put yourself in the shoes of the injured party, okay? And I think of, if I took a piece of paper and passed it down this bench and I said, all of you, would you sign an authorization for me to look at your bank accounts? And my response, if someone did that to me, was, it's none of your business. Okay, now I'm not speaking legalese. I'm just saying, now, and I think for me, I have an expectation that my bank accounts aren't going to be subject to everyone. Is that expectation reasonable? My response is, it's none of your business. It's my business. I have an expectation. Is it reasonable? Well, if I were the subject of a criminal proceeding, I would have expectation ameliorated, because if there's probable cause or something, that would justify an invasion of my privacy. If this were a civil under 80507 and they wanted to do that, they would have to, under B, I think, a notice of a third-party subpoena issued for discovery, probably have to give 10 days before the scheduled notice or some kind of notice. So what do I do with that? I mean, you can talk about, and we do here, all of these legal theories, but my response is, it seems like most people would respond, it's none of your business.
Well, I think there's levels of reasonableness. One level is the Fourth Amendment level of reasonableness, reasonable expectation of privacy. And if it's that situation, if there is, if bank records do enjoy that, then of course there's both standing to contest it and suppression is the remedy if there was a violation of the warrant requirement or the exception to the warrant. You have a different level of reasonableness, I would argue, where if the Constitution doesn't protect it, if there is no constitutional reasonable expectation or legitimate expectation of privacy, there may be some expectation that stems from a statute or from your contract with the bank or whatever that may be, but that then depends on the language of those provisions. And then the question becomes, what if those provisions are violated? And our argument here is that if there was a statutory violation, but the remedy is not suppression of the records. For two reasons. One, because it doesn't say that. If the legislature really wanted to single out bank records for a heightened expectation of privacy, it could have said that. And could have said, if you don't follow this to the letter, we're going to suppress. The court has to suppress. The other aspect, I think, of this case that's important to note with respect to the statute is that at the time this action was taken, albeit improperly and erroneously, the state of the law, both federally and in Wisconsin, was there was no constitutional expectation, reasonable expectation of privacy for search and seizure provisions. When this was also done, there was actually an affidavit that the police officer prepared, and his report in the record that precedes effort to get the subpoenas shows that he did have probable cause. There was a misstep then or an oversight in the prosecutor's office, although the record isn't developed, and the prosecutor said, we're not saying that we did this right. I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought here. But two judges, nonetheless, signed off on this. The bank had the opportunity to say, no, wait a minute, these aren't the right subpoenas, there's no case number on here, we haven't been given an opportunity to contest this. So you have some checks in this system. Now, they're not perfect checks, but I guess I would submit that you have to look then at the nature of bank records. And part of this, if I may, I'll go into that, which is the Miller rationale.
Could I, before you move there,
sure.
I want to
talk a little bit about what you were just talking about. Now, if the court decides, oops, I issued the subpoena and I shouldn't have, right, can the court essentially move to quash it?
Good question. I think if, I mean, sua sponte, if it said, you know, I've looked at this again, I shouldn't have granted probable cause, I would suspect that while it's still in its jurisdiction, it has authority to do that, certainly. It could review it. You would think that the party would bring it up, but I think while the matter is before the court, it can say, wait a minute, I made a mistake here. You shouldn't have gotten those records.
I want to take you back to where you left off with Justice Bradley before you move on, and I know you want to move on, but and I understand your argument with respect to the Congress and them providing a remedy of suppression if they had wanted to, or the legislature wanting to provide a remedy if they had intended to. But I think we've all seen a growth of how industry deals with its consumers since the Miller case was decided, whether we're talking about credit card transactions or whether we're talking about bank transactions. You mentioned the issue of the contracts that exist between the banks or the credit card companies and the consumer. And I know that many of those involve privacy agreements between the bank or the credit card companies and the consumers. And with respect to that, and I don't know if any of the contracts may be in the record in this case. I didn't go back and look for that.
In part, they are.
If the contract provides the consumer with an expectation that the bank records for that consumer would be held private, and I'm prefacing by if because I haven't seen it yet, but if that is what the consumer is told, doesn't that alter at least the lens that the U.S. Supreme Court had when it made its determination on the Fourth Amendment? Because prior to those agreements, you wouldn't have a reasonable expectation of privacy because you hadn't been told that. But if your bank is telling you, we will keep this private, and there's limited access and not everybody's going to get that, wouldn't that have an interplay on whether or not a person's expectation may or may not be reasonable?
I don't think so in terms of the constitutional analysis. And I guess I'd refer the court to the two cases that followed Miller, Smith versus Maryland and United States versus Painter. They're 1979 and 1980, both of which came after the Rights of Financial Privacy Act, which was enacted in 1978 as a response to Miller. The Privacy Act provided certain rights and remedies to bank customers, but it doesn't apply to state law enforcement, and suppression is not a remedy. It's a little bit civil rights. So even in response to Miller, the Congress did not see suppression as a remedy.
No, I accept your argument with respect to legislation.
But the Supreme Court, in the wake of that legislation, decided two cases. One, the Smith versus Maryland, was the pen register case, where telephone numbers that are dialed are not considered, obtaining those numbers are not considered a search because that person is exposing that information to the phone company and assumes the risk that that third-party phone company will disclose it. In Painter, which I think is even more helpful, if you will, to the state, that was a situation where IRS agents obtained the defendant's bank records by breaking into a bank officer's briefcase and photographing the records. And despite that possibly criminal activity, the Supreme Court still said that the bank records themselves were admissible against the defendant.
I'm not sure that addresses my question, though, because that does not address the concept of when the bank makes representations to the consumer that we will keep your records private. That's an entirely different situation than looking at the situations you just described where the U.S. Supreme Court has recognized there's no constitutional interest, at least as of the Miller case. Nobody's told you that there's a constitutional interest. The Congress has said if there's a violation, they provided civil remedies and haven't provided you with suppression. I think it's a totally different lens than when your bank is telling you, we're not going to share this.
Sure. I think I agree then with you, but I guess my argument then is that that's a discussion or a contract or an agreement between the bank and the customer. It doesn't involve implicate the Fourth Amendment then.
Doesn't it involve one's, that's why I'm pressing you. It involves one's reasonableness of their privacy interest,
sure.
Does it not?
It would certainly, reasonable expectation of privacy is an evolving concept that may change as circumstances change.
But it really doesn't have to do whether you think it's private. And you, because it's a fiction and it's an objective test that the court sets forth under the Fourth Amendment.
That's where I'm getting. This, the fact that banks perhaps uniformly have this confidentiality or privacy aspect to them and the customer expects that is an indicia perhaps that in our society bank records might deserve some greater protection. But as the Chief just suggested, we need to look at everything here to decide whether there is an objective requirement that we're going to recognize constitutionally.
Mr. Primus, let me ask you this. You got a situation where the statute says got to have probable cause. Probable cause wasn't shown. The subpoena was issued. You say suppression is not the remedy. Is there any remedy?
I think that the remedies that are available in the current state of affairs is simply civil remedies that the defendant, whatever they may have, the suspect, Popenhagen, may have against the third party that disposes them, if there's like a contractual promise not to. In other words, what I'm trying to do is equate bank records and banks, well, bank records, with other documents that are voluntarily disclosed to third parties, garbage. I mean, in garbage, unless you have a shredder, I mean, you're actually exposing to the public, potentially, all kinds of information about oneself, and of course that's the basis for identity theft quite often. Anything that the suggestion that I'm, or the argument that I'm making is that bank records don't deserve this heightened expectation of privacy, because when you're doing this, you're knowing what you're doing, you're voluntarily giving certain information to the bank, you're aware that this, for example, if you write a check, it's going to go through the stream of commerce, various people are going to see it, the payee is going to give it to their bank. It goes through a certification process, those employees. There's just not what we would consider the normal privacy expectation, other than what the bank is telling you is going to happen with those types of records. And that, I think that is why to import a suppression remedy in the statute where none is provided for, and especially under, and even if this court were to do it, I'm suggesting don't do it in this case, because the circumstances of the law and the nature of the law at this time were such that the state couldn't expect that, or she couldn't, the defendant couldn't expect to have that kind of protection based
on that. Yes, my reaction is how do we deter law enforcement abuse if we don't allow for suppression? Let me go back to the case that Mr. Connell was arguing, the Hoyer case, which goes back into the, I think, about 1922. That case certainly was concerned with deterring abuse by law enforcement. If we say, hey, statute says probable cause, you didn't have probable cause, so what? How do we deter abuse?
My answer, again, is it's twofold. One is the process that's set up where you have a judge or judges potentially reviewing this, and the process of the third party who under our argument, has the right to these documents and the authority to disclose them. Those are the sufficient protective mechanisms to avoid any kind of floodgates that might, you know, that we're just going to ignore this statute. I don't think that's, you know, you expect the trial judges to act accordingly with that. Short of that, so long as bank records don't have this heightened degree of protection, and so long as the statute doesn't provide for a suppression remedy, my argument would be that the suspect is left to her civil remedies.
Counsel, suppose the court would hold that the bank records are protected by the Fourth Amendment. That is, there's a reasonable expectation of privacy. I don't mean Fourth Amendment. I'm talking about the state constitution. Law enforcement is really not hindered because all law enforcement has to do is have probable cause to obtain those records under 968. So all they have to do is follow the statute. That is, all they have to do is be reasonable, and the statute here sets forth a reasonableness. So, I mean, the world doesn't come to an end. They can still find, IRS can go out after a case and get the bank records, et cetera.
Sure. There's two things that the court would have to distinguish. If it's going to find a state constitutional right, then you have to have a warrant or a warrant exception to get those, as I understand it. And if it's a statutory remedy that you're going to – a statutory suppression remedy, then we're talking about, you know, you only need a subpoena to get the bank records, and we're not going to say they're covered by the Constitution.
But under but either one, all you need is probable cause.
As a practical matter, probable cause, sure. A warrant, you know, so long as they do it, I mean, I think for future purposes, fine.
Not a problem.
But I'm suggesting that in this, if you will, oddball situation or unique set of circumstances, suppression really isn't appropriate under the circumstances that are present here.
One of the feelings I got from reading the Miller case was that somehow the court thought the world would come to an end. They couldn't get the bank records if they were protected under the Fourth Amendment. It didn't make any sense to me. I mean, because they can. Government can get these bank records even if they're protected. They just have to do it right.
Well, I think, again, it would be the difference between whether you have to have a subpoena or a warrant.
Right. Both needing probable cause.
In Wisconsin, certainly, yes.
And both going before a judge.
Correct.
Then under that argument, counsel, we don't really need 968-135. It just writes it out of existence, because if they're protected under the Constitution, you can't use that statute ever to get these records. You have to have a warrant to get them, right?
That's right. The difference, the reason you need the statute is when you're talking about documents that are in, that don't have Fourth Amendment or state constitutional protection, because they're in the possession or ownership or whatever of the third party, that third party can refuse to give those documents over. You have to have a mechanism to get that third party to comply. That's where the subpoena comes in. That's where the contempt sanction for noncompliance, assuming the subpoena process, is followed. One thing I would just note in terms of the federal legislation also, in Miller they were talking about the and California Bankers Association versus Schultz, about the Bank Secrecy Act of 1970. That was the federal statute that required banks to maintain customer records. And in the federal statute, the reason for that was because those records, quote, have a high degree of usefulness in criminal, tax, and regulatory investigations and proceedings. So clearly the legislation even then was aimed at, this is not a mechanism to necessarily protect the bank customer. It's a mechanism. It's not a Fourth Amendment protection for those purposes. The act was not made entirely to protect the customer from government action to obtain those records. I see my time is up.
Thank you, Mr. Primus.
Thank you.
Mr. Connor. Sorry.
There is a reasonable expectation of privacy in bank records. In 2007, people cannot function without a bank account. You can't get credit. You can't buy things that you need. You can't live in this economy, in this society, without a bank account.
Counselor, if I buy your argument, then doesn't that nullify the use of 968-135?
Well, perhaps we do need a warrant.
I buy your argument, I have to go there, don't I?
That's correct. There is a reasonable expectation of privacy. As the Attorney General has just mentioned, banks are required by law to maintain records. And what do our bank records show? Well, if you saw my bank records, you would know what my hobbies are, what my interests are, what my religious affiliation is, who I owe money to, and what my net worth is. These are things that most reasonable people would believe are confidential, private matters that the government can't get by just requesting it. So I think that in this case, the court ought to find that there's a constitutional expectation of privacy in bank records. There's also been talk about what the remedy is for violation of Section 968.135. And while I'm urging you to overrule State versus Swift, the Court of Appeals decision in the 1970s, one of the things that the court did in that case, after finding that there, based on Miller, that there was no expectation of privacy, the court examined the probable cause portion of the subpoenas to determine whether probable cause was stated. Why would they do that? Well, because there is a remedy. If you don't state probable cause, the evidence must be suppressed. And we've also talked about the actual language of the statute that permits motions to quash, motions to limit. And in this case, of course, Michelle Popenhagen couldn't bring a motion to quash or limit the subpoena because she had no notice of the subpoena. But it also talks about other motions that may be brought. And it seems to me that if a third-party record keeper can bring a motion to quash a subpoena or to limit a subpoena, then the person whose records are being sought should also have the right to challenge the subpoena, albeit in this case the only way you could do it is after the fact, and that would be by a motion to suppress evidence. Finally,
go ahead.
I think there's been reference to standing in this case, and it really bothers me when they say that Michelle Popenhagen has no standing to challenge the government's action in this matter. The government's position sort of underscores an individual's present defenselessness with respect to records maintained about him or her. Who is there who can raise issues if it's not the people in trouble, if it's not Michelle Popenhagen? Those are the people that contest the limits of government authority and the limits of legal protection. And if those protections are not there for a person like Michelle Popenhagen, they're not there for anyone. And that's why I urge that the court find the constitutional protection for this lady in this case. You know, we've made mention of the 1923 decision that has been referred to as a watershed of Wisconsin law, where we adopted the exclusionary rule. And in that case, this court spoke about the pledge of faith that is contained in Article 1, Section 11. And it said, this security has vanished and the pledge is violated by the state that guarantees it when officers of the state under color of state-given authority search and seize unlawfully. That's what happened in this case. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Connell. Thank you, Mr. Frymuth, for your arguments today on yet another search and seizure case that comes before this court with some regularity, different posture, and different kinds of articles seized. That concludes our argument in 2006 AG 1114 CR State of Wisconsin versus Popenhagen. We are in recess for lunch until 1:30.